Of the Lord, continuing in our study of the life, not even the life, but a part of the little teeny inkling part of the life of the prophet Elijah that we find in the tail end of 1 Kings and the beginning chapter or two of 2 Kings. He's noted in the Bible as being perhaps the greatest of prophets. He makes the New Testament appearance in the Transfiguration along with Moses. We know that he was only one of two people that are said not to have died. And so we understand that Elijah was and still seems to have some very great importance in the big picture of God bringing to us his eternal kingdom. We studied how, because of the apostasy of Ahab the king and his wife Jezebel the queen, who was the daughter of one of the Sidonian kings. So Ahab is married outside of Israel to begin with. And when she came, she brought with her pagan idols. She was a worshiper of Baal. And one of the things Ahab did was he built a temple for Baal in the capital city of Samaria. And he went there himself and he made sacrifices on that altar. So it's just a measure of how morally and religiously corrupt Israel itself has become at this point in its history. And it was during that time and in that context that God sent forth this great prophet that we know as Elijah. Last week, we studied an example of Old Testament resurrection, because God has sent Elijah first to the brook Cherith, and he's provided for him there through the ravens and through the brook and all of that. And then he sent him to this place called Seraphith, which is in Sidonia. It's near Sidon. It's right in Jezebel's backyard. And there he's provided for Elijah through a widowed woman there who has given him bread and sustained him through that. And we know that God sustained not only Elijah through it, but also the man in his or the widow and her son, and even the rest of her household, through an endless jar of flour and an endless bucket of oil. And just remember, as this is going on, there are people around them starving to death. Conditions in Israel and the surrounding nations have gotten to be unbelievably bad, because as we read this today, we're going to find out now it's been going on for almost 3 years. Not one drop of rain has fallen in the nation of Israel. And it's hard for us to even conceive of a place like that. We think about desert, right? If you think about no rain, your first thing you think about, this place had to have been like a desert. So we need to understand this. And this was that land that was described early on in the Bible as a land flowing with milk and honey. And now we have to understand it was little more than a barren wasteland. And all because of the apostasy of Ahab and so many of the Israelites. They, in essence, have turned away from God. Not that God's turned away from them, but they have turned away from God. And this is the consequences of it. And the sad thing about it is this, is even in the midst of it, it never dawns on them that what is causing this calamity that's fallen upon them. They put the blame on Elijah. The last verse is where we left last week, and we're going to pick up at that real quick. Then the woman said to Elijah, and this is after her son was raised from the dead, "Now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord in your mouth is truth," or is certain. This woman has seen a great miracle. I mean, how many of you have ever seen anything as significant as the fact that God provided for you in a very miraculous way while everybody around you was starving to death or something like that? So we've seen this woman has actually seen God working miraculously, mightily already. And then the resurrection of her son. All of this validates for her that indeed Elijah is a man of God, that Elijah is a true prophet of God, that he speaks the very word, the certainty of God's word. To raise the dead, I would imagine most of us think would be quite phenomenal. You think about Egypt. When Moses first started doing things, the Egyptian magicians were able to duplicate some of that stuff. They could take water and make it into blood. Not the whole Nile River. So we would probably rank the way he's provided for them food, sustenance over these days is a pretty big miracle. But we'd probably say something like raising the dead would be once we saw something like that, we would know that in fact this is a God thing. There is no other possible explanation for people being raised from the dead other than God did it. You've heard me say this many times before, and that is that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was the thing that the nail that put the nail in the coffin of people who doubted that Jesus really was the Son of God. You think about the disciples. They went around with Jesus. They saw the healings. They saw him casting out demons. They saw him. They were there when he fed 5,000 and then 4,000 people with just a few little things of bread and a few small fish. They were there, they witnessed him calming the storm. But even when they came to his tomb on that Easter Sunday, they doubted the resurrection of the dead. But what we see is that when they did that, when they understood that Jesus and he came to them and he showed himself to them and they knew that he had been dead and they knew that he was now alive, it was the thing that convinced them the doubt they had up to that point evaporated away. What was it that changed the Apostle Paul? This Pharisee among Pharisees who was going around and persecuting Christians, putting them in prison and rejoicing when they were killed. And he wasn't just satisfied to do it in Jerusalem. He got papers to go to Damascus and do the same thing. But I wish I could have been there to see Paul, as it began to sink into him, as this voice comes to him and is talking to him and saying to him, Paul, Paul, or Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? What's going on in Paul's head? He's thinking, I've been persecuting people who believe that rubbish. I've been put in my prison. I've had people killed. I'm going to Damascus to do the same thing all over again. And he's talking to me now? Uh-oh. That must mean that he really is alive. You see, guys, the resurrection is the key. And so often today, you don't hear a whole lot about the resurrection, even in the church. But it's the key thing. It's the thing that I struggled with personally for a long time. I had to be convinced of the resurrection before I ever would become a Christian. It truly is remarkable. It truly is phenomenal. Because it says this to us. This undoubtedly is a thing of God Himself who gives life, takes life, and gives it again. So we need to understand that when we're reading, studying resurrections in the Old Testament, they're only preludes to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And preludes to the resurrection of all people that's coming at the time he returns to the earth. Chapter 18. Now it happened after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go, show yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the face of the earth." So Elijah went to show himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. Ahab called Obadiah, who was over the household. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for when Jezebel destroyed the prophets of the Lord, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. Then Ahab said to Obadiah, "Go through the land to all the springs of water into all the valleys. Perhaps we will find grass and keep the horses and mules alive and not have to kill some of the cattle." So they divided the land between them to survey it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. They're just a measure of how severe. Because anytime you have drought, it always leads to famine also, right? So it's not this just there's no rain, but now there's no food in Israel either. Not for the people and not even for the cattle. Well, from the very beginning, the very first verse that we read, the beginning of chapter 17, tells us that this was going to go on for years, but it doesn't tell us for how many years. But now we know. They are in the third year. I want you to notice some things here. One of those is this. Is the Lord has already told Elijah to go twice. Once to Cherith, once to Zarephath, and he did it. God said go, and he went. And we understand that that was for a lot of reasons. It was God's way of providing for the prophet during those very hard and harsh times and all of that. But you also know this. We know that Ahab was doing his best all through those years of trying to find Elijah so he could kill him, because he blamed him for this calamity that's fallen on Israel. He's been like on the FBI's most wanted list at the very top now for years. And we know that God hid him away so that Ahab couldn't find him. And now God tells him, go to the very man I've hidden you from for almost 3 years. That man who, by the way, wants to kill you. And again, what we're going to find is Elijah's faith leads him into obedience. God says to do it, so he does it. Without question, without gripe, without complaint. God says go, and he goes. There's a clear connection here that you may have heard me speak about this before, but I think it's important for us. We're talking about rain on the earth. It's rain on the Yadamach, which basically is, I don't know if you realize it or not, but it's directly connected with another word that sounds similar, and we say Adam, right? Adam, the very son of God, the first man. Need to understand in Genesis, there's a connection made between mankind, man, and the earth. That this is where God put us. And I know some of you believe we're going to spend the rest of eternity in heaven, but the Bible doesn't teach us that. What the Bible teaches is we're going to spend the rest of eternity as believers in the new heavens and the new earth. In other words, the earth is going to be renewed. It's going to be made in perfection. without any of the vestiges remaining upon it of the consequences of mankind's sin or anything like that. It's going to be a new earth. But you need to understand something, that God, Jesus is going to come back, and when the Bible talks about him coming back, it never says he leaves the earth again in a physical sense. God made Adam out of the dust of the earth to fill the earth. You may not understand what God's ultimate purpose is for people and for the earth. And I'll tell you right now what it is. One of the primary things he's doing is this, is he's filling the earth with those who love him and those who worship him. Man is made from the dust of the ground. To the dust he will go, and from the dust he will return. The resurrection. It's been almost 3 years now, and no rain, but now God says it's time. It's time. The rain will come again, and the rain will once again fall on the face of the earth. Verse 2, so Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. Now the famine was severe in Samaria. Now some of you probably know a little bit about Samaria, and some of you don't know much about it. But when we think about Samaria, what do we think about? We think about the Samaritan woman at the well. We think about the Good Samaritan. So our understanding of Samaria or Samaritan comes most basically from the New Testament. But you need to understand that Samaria in the Old Testament, it was the capital city of the northern kingdom, of what continued to be called Israel after the kingdom divided. Omri, the father of Ahab, is the one who built Samaria. Now we need to understand something. That was a direct affront toward God. Because what did God say about Jerusalem? That it was a place where his name dwelt. And we understand that there was a temple. Even as this was going on, there was a temple in Jerusalem. And it was a place inside that Holy of Holies above the Ark of the Covenant where God himself dwelt among man. And instead of worshiping that God in the place that the God had named his worshipers to come to and to worship him, he built his own city. And one of the things he did in that city was he built a temple to Baal. He didn't build a temple to the Lord God of Israel. He built a temple to Baal. And as we said before, he went there and he actually made sacrifices himself on that altar to the storm god of the Babylon of the Sidonians, the Phoenicians. Same sort of thing happened with him that happened with Solomon, and that is they married foreign wives, and those wives led them into idol pagan worship. It's happened over and over again. And it doesn't register. Who do they blame? They blame Elijah. Notice here that the famine, the drought slash famine, was severe in Samaria. It sounds like it was the worst of all of it. It was bad everywhere. It was unbelievably bad everywhere. But it was the most bad in Samaria. In other words, God had a special eye on that place. And the worst of it was right there under the nose of Ahab and Jezebel. It'd be nice if we could read that they repented and they returned to the Lord their God and all that. But what we see is this, and this is how it is with people very often. When their heart is hardened against God, stuff like this happens, their heart gets harder and harder and harder and harder. Now, very often, God uses things like this to break people. He did that with me. He brought me to crisis. And I'm sure he did the same thing with a lot of you guys when it came time for you to hear his calling and to come to him. Very often it happens right in the midst of very great crisis. Verse 3. Ahab summoned Obadiah, who was over the palace. Now, Obadiah was devoutly fearing the Lord. Obadiah, the word there, the name there, is one of these. We've seen this a number of times as we've really looked about language and what the meaning of names are, you know, in more recent months. But Obadiah literally means household servant or slave. And that's what he was. He was a household servant. But he wasn't just any household servant. He was the overseer of the royal palace. Very much like Joseph was as far as Potiphar goes. He was the overseer. He was the manager. He was the top dog as far as the servants went. This is who Obadiah was. That was a position that wasn't given to just anybody. It was someone that there was great trust in, because they had lots of responsibility. You think about Obadiah, think about Joseph. When he was in Potiphar's house, he was doing the same thing. But just like there was a big difference between Joseph and Potiphar, there's a huge difference between Obadiah and Ahab, his master. Obadiah is a God-fearer. Now, you've probably heard this before, because fear in the Bible sometimes means one thing and sometimes it means other things. Very often it really means fear, like we think of fear, that you're terrified of something. There is another sense in which sometimes it's used to mean really more of revering. But let me tell you, that revering is always based upon a healthy fearing. In other words, understanding that God is a God to be feared. He really is. I mean, all power in heaven and earth is unto him. And people that just think that they can change his mind, you know, and correct his misunderstanding of things, and that's laughable. But people do that all the time. We try to convince him to do what we think he ought to do. Who? Isn't that crazy? I want you to notice here that that his devotion is demonstrated in practical righteousness. Another way to look at this is you could just say this. This would be more in church terms today, and that is this, is Obadiah was a believer. Right there in the center of the household of Ahab and Jezebel, the top dog nonetheless, in their household, the person they trusted most. Well, if we were reading into 1 Kings 21, we're going to skip over it because it doesn't really, Elijah's not part of that particular narrative there, but there's a story there about a guy named Naboth. You've heard of that? Naboth's vineyards. This man, this devout man that lived near the palace, and his family inheritance was close to the palace, and Ahab really wanted him to give him or sell him his family inheritance, which in Israel you didn't do. He refused to do it, and what did Ahab do? He pouted. He went pouting to his wife. And his wife contrived and convinced people to be a part of this conspiracy to have Naboth murdered so that Ahab could have his vegetable garden, need the palace. The sad thing is all that took place and Ahab was fine with it. That's how wicked and evil he was. Is that the heart of a king? He really has the hearts of the people in the center of all of it. You ever notice that sometimes you find believers in very unlikely places? There's some examples of it in the Bible. The one I want to bring to your attention this morning is this. Is remember Paul, you know, later on in his ministry, he was arrested. He was arrested in the years of Nero. He was actually executed in the days of Nero. Nero was Caesar when Paul died because of his faith. And when he was arrested, there were many people in the church at that time that were really put back a lot. And it's like, gosh, why would God let something like that happen? Why is it that Paul has been in prison? This isn't good for the church. It's not good for the spread of the gospel. It's not good for the kingdom of God. And they were fretting and they were worried and they were concerned about the church in essence dying because now Paul couldn't do ministry like he had done before. That's why I wrote Philippians, to address those issues and those concerns. And what he enlightens them to is this, is that through his imprisonment, there have been doorways that have opened up to him for sharing the gospel and spreading the kingdom that probably never would have otherwise. In other words, he saw his imprisonment as a good thing, a way that to advance the gospel in places it wouldn't go. And like with all of Paul's letters, he has in the closing, he greets people and, you know, special message to so-and-so and all this other kind of stuff. And this is what he says as he ends Philippians. The brethren who are with me greet you. In other words, he's not there by himself. God hasn't left him in prison and he's isolated from everybody. Nothing like that. But then he says this. Especially, particularly, those of the household of in other words, here you have Nero. He's got Christians, and he hated Christians. You need to understand that. One of the most horrible things that we've ever heard of is that he used to burn Christians as torches to give light to his nightly evening parties. He was wicked. He was awful. He was terrible. Right under his nose, there were believers. Same thing is true with Obadiah. Right here in the very household of Ahab. A God-fearing man. And that showed in how he lived his life and what he did. Verse 4, when Jezebel was killing the prophets of God, Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them, each 50 in a cave, and supplied them with bread and water under their nose. Some things here are really enlightening to us. Very often we might have the idea that Elijah was only one. And actually, he kind of has that mentality himself later on. It's like, I'm the only one. I'm the only one that cares. I'm the only one who's preaching and teaching and prophesying in God's name. That's not an accurate picture. Because what we're told here, that Jezebel took 100 prophets. 100 prophets. And we're not talking about false prophets. We're talking about true prophets of God. The Nabi, those that God promised all the way back at Sinai that he would raise up from among their countrymen and they would speak forth his word. Sometimes I think we have the idea, like, do you ever have the idea, it's like, I'm the only one who cares. I'm the only one that's, Elijah was not the only true prophet. Now, we know a lot more about him. We don't know any of these by their names, but we know that they were out and they were speaking God's word. They weren't false prophets. You ever hear of Corrie ten Boom? If you've never heard of Corrie ten Boom, you need to hear of Corrie ten Boom. She wrote a book called The Hiding Place, and it had to do with, it was during World War II, in the beginning of World War II, when the Netherlands were invaded by the Nazis. She was Dutch. Her family was Dutch. And they started taking Jewish people in and hiding them away from the Gestapo. They were found out. They were actually betrayed by someone. And the family was sent to a concentration camp. Corrie and her sister Betsy were together for a while, but eventually her sister Betsy died. Her father died in another internment camp. But that book is about all of that. Obadiah, hiding God's people. The difference is he didn't get caught. And the amazing thing is he did it right under Ahab and Jezebel's nose, because you wonder where in the world he got provisions. I mean, in this land that is full of drought, full of famine, people are starving to death, where in the world did he get bread to give on a regular basis, perhaps daily, probably daily, to these prophets when people were starving in this land where there really wasn't any bread? Well, we know that God provided it for him, but I would not be surprised at all if he wasn't taking it from the allotment that was given to the palace, to the king and to the queen. Because in those days, the king and the queen, they were those elite people. You know, they were above everybody else. And so if there was any bread available, who got it? It wasn't the people. It was the king and his household. But here you have Obadiah taking enough to provide for these prophets that he's hidden specifically from Jezebel, right under her nose. Verse 5, Ahab said to Obadiah, go throughout the land to all the springs of water and to all the valleys. Perhaps we can find grass and keep a horse and mule alive, so we will not have to kill any of the domesticated animals. Can you imagine what it would be like for there to be no rain in Florida for 3 years? We still have bald spots in our grass from going through about a month of what we thought was pretty droughty conditions at our house. So could you imagine what Florida would be like? Florida's known. Have you ever seen a topical graphic map of Florida, like maybe a picture of Florida from the air, looking down on it? How so much of it is blue? I mean, Florida is noted for a lot of things, and one of those is this: is there's water all over the place, ponds and lakes and rivers and streams, retention areas. Lots of water. Can you imagine what Florida would look like if we did not have any rain for 3 years? Would you want to live here? What if we didn't have a rain for 3 months? Would you want to still live here? What about 6 months or a year? Would you still want to live here? What would we be doing? We would be leaving and going other places. The Promised Land was also noted to be a place where water was plentiful. Springs of water coming up from the ground, sides of hills and in the valleys. That's how it's described. Springs are basically just openings in the ground through which groundwater is forced to the surface, right? A few springs around here. You see, that's another thing that Florida is noted for, is having springs of water. And you and I know this, that if it got to the point that the only place you could find water at all was from a spring, and there probably was not much of that, just think about Rainbow Springs or think about Silver Springs, that million gallons of water coming out into Silver Springs every day, or is it every hour? Not how much it is, but it's an unbelievable amount of water being forced out of the ground to the surface constantly. What if it became a trickle? You getting a picture of what's going on here? Another thing we should glean from this too is this, is it seems like they were more concerned about the animals than they were the people. Some people think I don't like animals. You know, cats and dogs and things like that. I get razzed by it all the time. But I actually spent 3 years trying to get into vet school, and maybe that's why I'm not that animal friendly today, because I have a bitterness about me because I never got in. But doesn't it bother you sometimes today how it seems like some people care more about animals than they care about people? There's a lot of that going on. You know, you have these advertisements for the Audubon Society on TV, and I'm not telling you we need to be cruel to animals or anything like that, but I need you to remember this, and that is, animals are not people. People are far greater value than animals are, because they are the only ones that are made in the image of God. They're very special to Him. Therefore, they have to be very, very extremely special to us. And everything else should be secondary. So one of the things you see about Ahab's heart here is he's concerned about keeping his animals alive because he doesn't want to get rid of his horse and he doesn't have to kill any of his cows or sheep or anything else. While there are people starving to death all around him. What about wildlife? Do you think the countryside has changed at all in regard to the wildlife through these years? I mean, where they're, or do they need grass? Do they need water? The deer, the antelope, whatever else was there, the wild goats? Did they need all of those things? Surely. I've never really thought so much about this condition of which the land would have been in at that time, just by applying some basic common sense. What do starving people do to the wildlife? It's food, right? One of the things that amazed Lori and I is this, is in certain places in Uganda when we were there, because we go there, oh, we're going to see monkeys all over the place, we're going to see snakes all over the place too, but we didn't see that much wildlife. And the reason is because the people were starving, and so the wildlife, they eat it. So again, here you have this land of milk and honey. It's so barren. They have to look desperately to find a few blades of grass. So he divided the land to cover. Ahab went in one direction by himself, and Obadiah in another direction by himself. Don't sound like much of a kingly thing to be doing as far as I can discern. I mean, kings are those people who say, you go do this, you go do this, you do this, and I'm just sitting here and do nothing. They had servants that did all this kind of stuff. They had soldiers. So you wonder why in the world Ahab took it upon himself to do this to start with, and I think it probably is a measure of just how desperate the situation's gotten. That the king is willing to do something menial like this. And not only that, you have not a servant of Ahab, not a son or daughter of a servant. You have the head guy in the palace. He's out there looking for blades of grass too. They go off by themselves. All alone. Well, they may or may not find the grass they seek. But they are going to come across something they don't expect. Actually, someone they don't expect. And that's where we're going next week.